Welcome to the Seam Lund Podcast. I'm your host, Seam Lund, and today our guest is Dr. James DiNicolantonio. Dr. James and I released our new book called The Blood Sugar Fix, How to Achieve Optimal Blood Sugar Levels and Insulin Sensitivity for a Healthier and Longer Life. You can get the book from Amazon. Wait, what number is this now? It's like a sixth book or something like that.
Yeah, and
this one, this time, is kind of a continuation in a lot of ways to the Obesity Fix. Because it kind of covers something very similar, like in terms of metabolic dysfunction and like obesity and diabetes and blood sugar dysregulation and insulin resistance. They're very like closely connected to each other. So yeah, maybe we can start with, you know, what is some of the things that people need to look out for when it comes to, let's say, glucose intolerance, and what are like, how do they actually know if they're, if they have some, you know, problems related to that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I mean, I think a lot of people like inherently know sugar sweetened beverages are bad for you, for your blood sugar, and so a lot of people will kind of cut that out and think that's enough. And this book really sort of takes many different things into account, and that if you hit each checkbox, it's definitely going to improve your blood sugar levels. So you know, whether that's being under muscled and not having the muscle to soak up the glucose and to handle a combination of carbs and fat, which we talk about, like the Randall cycle, and how when you combine two macronutrients, unless you're kind of highly active or you have a good amount of muscle, your body has a hard time metabolizing both carbs and fats at the same time, which can eventually elevate blood sugar levels. A lot of people too, I think, in the real world, are eating a lot of like whole grains, thinking it's healthy, but that's contributing to a lot of elevation in blood sugar levels. We know, and we discuss this in the book too, that refined sugars are actually more harmful than refined carbohydrates, and they're hidden in everything. 75% of the packaged foods in the United States contain hidden added sugars, which is a problem. And then one thing that we touch on as well that really hasn't been covered in other books is numerous nutrient deficiencies can lead to not just elevations in blood sugar, but have literally been shown to cause pre-diabetes and diabetes. And we can, you know, cover that as well. But that's sort of like an overall umbrella of what the Blood Sugar Fix book is.
Yeah. So, it, you know, obviously it's not only about, yeah, like diabetes, although it can help the, you know, pathology and symptoms of diabetes. It's more, yeah, about like, the main message is like prevention. How do you make sure that you don't develop this poor glucose tolerance? And like, what are the things to do to just overall improve your insulin sensitivity? Because I mean, it's just healthier to have better glucose, you know, metabolism and insulin sensitivity, which then, you know, determines your other like disease risk as well. Like, because if you have diabetes, then your risk of cardiovascular disease doubles at least, and the risk of dying prematurely also increases quite significantly, because diabetics, they do have like a 5 to 10 year shorter life expectancy just from diabetes alone. And if you get like cardiovascular disease as well from that, then that can be like 20 years shorter life expectancy, quite, you know, easily.
Right. Yeah. And that brings up a good point too. A lot of heart attacks are actually caused by pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes, but really aren't labeled as such, right? Like most people don't view it as you had a heart attack because you've had elevated insulin and glucose for 20 years. Most people just kind of blame it on red meat or eggs or salt or saturated fat and say, that's why you had a heart attack. And the thing is too, is we don't really diagnose type 2 diabetes until someone's had the disease for at least a decade and they've lost like 50% of their beta cells. So it's really a disease of metabolism. Like you are, your actual machinery, your engine isn't fully able to kind of get substrates through the full process of the Krebs cycle and give you the full ATP output. It's like things are sort of backing up. You're going into actual harmful pathways. You're forming more advanced glycation end products. So it's really like a disease of metabolism causing enhanced oxidative stress, and elevated glucose and insulin are like a symptom of basically the clogged up machinery.
Yeah. In Estonia, like the translation of diabetes is like sugar disease. But there's actually like at least like a dozen different other contributing factors to getting diagnosed with diabetes. And it's just that the end result usually is this hyperglycemia, higher blood sugar levels, chronically elevated blood sugar levels that don't go down, you know, as a normal person should do, because it's like normal to still have like these swings and blood sugar every day. Like when you eat something, it's normal for your blood sugar to rise, and in a healthy metabolism the blood sugar goes down because the body releases insulin, and the body is insulin sensitive to or the cells are insulin sensitive to respond to the insulin and let the glucose into the cells. But in diabetes, like over time, what happens is that, you know, the insulin production isn't enough, like the diabetics don't produce enough insulin, or the cells are resistant to the insulin so that they're kind of, you know, shut off from the message or the signal of insulin. And that's why the blood sugar stays elevated for much longer. And that's like generally the characteristic of diabetes, like this hyperglycemia plus insulin resistance, that the cells don't respond to insulin.
Right.
And for some, like, you know, actual numbers for people to look at, like your blood sugar levels obviously are one of the like diagnostic tools for diagnosing like either pre-diabetes or actual diabetes. If you have like a normal blood sugar in the morning should be like below 100 milligrams per deciliter, which is like less than 5.6 millimoles per liter. If you have, let's say, some aspects of impaired glucose tolerance or starting to indicate some pre-diabetes, then it's about 100 up to 125 milligrams or 5.6 to 7. And if you have above 126 milligrams or 7 millimoles, then that's diagnosed as diabetes in the, like, at least like the blood sugar marker. But there's also like the hemoglobin A1C that measures or indicates the average blood sugar over the past few weeks, and it measures like this glycated hemoglobin in the blood. And normal levels are less than 5.7%. Impaired glucose tolerance is 5.7% until 6.4%, and diabetes is over 6.5%.
Yep. And you know, a lot of, there's like certain buckets like that can contribute to elevations in glucose. And of course those elevations in glucose happen after elevations in insulin. So really a what's called a postprandial insulin assay, which basically you chug some glucose and you look at insulin levels for out to 4 hours. That will be higher. You'll be hyperinsulinemic for years, even decades, before you'll see elevations in, let's say, fasting glucose. And even before, you'll see elevations in postprandial glucose elevations, because high insulin will keep those postprandial glucose levels looking good, but you're basically producing way more insulin than a normal person to keep that glucose curve looking normal. So what happens, what contributes to that would be, there's so many different people in so many different buckets, and some people are in all the buckets, whether it's you're not lifting enough weights, you don't have enough muscle, you're over consuming bad, let's say, carbs and sugars. And so but then there's, within that, you actually don't even have to over consume calories to induce prediabetes and type 2 diabetes. If you get the total amount of sugars from added sugars in your diet at 15% or higher, that is enough to induce prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, even not in being in a caloric surplus. So, you know, there's an argument that says, well, in order to lose weight, you have to be in a calorie deficit, but you don't have to be in a calorie deficit. Or even if you are, if you have enough refined sugars, you can absolutely cause insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. So just being in a calories, let's say, deficit isn't a cure or a prevention for type 2 diabetes or prediabetes.
Yeah, it can certainly, like, it can probably create a bigger buffer zone, like, because if you're overeating calories and you eat a lot of sugars, then you probably get diabetes faster than being in a calorie deficit and right, overeating sugar. But it's just, you know, for like prevention, metabolic health, and optimal metabolic health, yeah, you need to have obviously like a good diet as well that doesn't have like a ton of added let's say refined carbohydrates and added sugars, because yeah, like those are probably one of the biggest, let's say, predictors of developing diabetes, like the consumption of sugar sweetened beverages and refined carbohydrates.
Right. And there are some studies that show if you eat like a 50% calorie deficit, which is tremendous. No one's going to be able to stay at that, like only eating 1,000 calories a day. If most of your calories are coming from refined sugars, like you won't gain weight. You probably won't develop type 2 diabetes right away. We don't really know. We don't have studies going out long enough, but that's in a severe calorie deficit. You know, we need studies that can actually apply to like, what is a typical person consuming in a day? We have numerous studies like that where people are consuming 2,700 calories a day and simply replacing, let's say, 20% of their calories from refined carbs with refined sugars causes worsening in insulin sensitivity, higher insulin levels, higher glucose levels. So we know actually refined sugars are more harmful than refined carbs, even when matched for calories and when being consumed at a normal calorie intake of, let's say, like 2,700 calories.
Mm, yeah. And why do, let's say, the liquid calories of sugar, why are those like worse?
Liquid calories are even worse, but this would just be like, say, let's say like refined white crystalline sugar is worse than refined like starch. But then a liquid form is even worse because the satiety from liquids is much less than food. So when you start consuming sugar sweetened beverages, there's been numerous studies that once you introduce them, total calorie intake automatically increases. So there's another argument that people will say, well, it doesn't matter as long as you keep your calories like, you know, in a calorie deficit, then, you know, whatever. But that's not what happens in the real world. When people start drinking sodas, start drinking sugar sweetened beverages, their calorie intake increases. So it is a harm of liquid sugar that causes more calories to be consumed. So you can't eliminate that harm and be like, well, if you just keep it at a calorie deficit, then liquid sugars aren't going to be harmful. That's great if we're all in a metabolic ward and we control people's total calorie intakes, but people live in the real world. And when you give them access to sugar sweetened beverages, unfortunately, their calorie intake increases.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of goes to the individual cases. Like there's, of course, you know, like examples of individuals being able to do that, like some, you know, high level, let's say a physically active person can obviously consume liquid, you know, sugars and added sugars as well and still maintain health and not develop diabetes. But yeah, like, but there is still like a clear, in epidemiology, there's a clear association between sugar sweetened beverage consumption and added sugar intake and diabetes. So yeah, like individually, you know, you and I, we can probably add sugar and you know, sodas into our diet and manage it in a, like a short term to not get any, you know, harmful changes to our biomarkers significantly. But like someone who, yeah, in the real world, who doesn't count calories or who don't know about the calorie content, etc., it's just that the association of that generally is associated with, yeah, increased calorie intake plus, you know, the worsening of biomarkers from that. And yeah, like in the real world, you know, the, you know, epidemiology is still in some ways, you know, epidemiology has a lot of flaws, but it's still, you know, in the real world, when you let people into the wild, so to say, into the wild of their free living world, then they're going to do what they're going to do. And yeah, there are just some associations which we know exist.
Yeah. I mean, even so, when it's not even just epidemiology, there's actually been numerous clinical studies where they give people access to sugar sweetened beverages. They literally start increasing their calorie intake. They gain more body fat just by giving them and having them and giving them access to sugar sweetened beverages. So it's been proven in numerous clinical studies. Actually, one of my presentations to the Canadian Senate was actually showed some of those clinical studies. But, you know, essentially, yeah, like if you're an active person, you know, you can get away with even some refined sugars, particularly post-exercise, right? Because your muscle is a tremendous source of glycogen storage, right? Where you can store a lot of glucose. So it depends on the person. It depends on their activity, depends on their nutrient background. But yeah, overall, I think reducing your amount of calories that come in liquid form is definitely going to be beneficial.
Yeah. And with the sugar sweetened beverages, it's one yeah, like thing that still happens. And I mean, it's less likely to happen in a calorie deficit, but especially in a calorie surplus, then what you do promote more is the visceral fat accumulation, which is like the internal fat around the organs, which we know is actually, one of the predictors of diabetes as well, because it kind of, you know, it's less metabolically active, or you can actually start to secrete more of these pro-inflammatory cytokines from there. And we know, like, you know, that the subcutaneous fat under the skin isn't that harmful than the visceral fat around the organs. And sugar-sweetened beverages, especially added fructose, the industrial fructose, not the fructose from the fruit, that is one of the biggest things that, you know, promotes the visceral fat gain as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's a fine line between, yes, being in a calorie deficit does help you handle more, let's say, sugars and things like that, but it doesn't prevent you from having harm from, let's say, a sugar bomb. Like when you consume a lot of added fructose, your cells metabolize that. And there's oxidative stress bursts that occur in the intestinal cells and in the kidney cells. And if you keep doing that, even if you're in a calorie deficit, you're going to start damaging organs. Just like a calorie deficit doesn't prevent your teeth from getting cavities if you consume sugar sweetened beverages. So there's certain harms that are going on that can't necessarily be eliminated just by being in a calorie deficit.
Yeah. And we shouldn't, you know, let's say, or actually, yeah, we can continue on with a little bit of on the carbohydrates and sugar side. So, you know, the amount of carbohydrates and the glycemic load of the food that you eat is one of the biggest predictors of, you know, how much your blood sugar rises in response to a meal. So we can maybe talk a little bit about, you know, what can we do? Obviously, most people already know that they shouldn't eat sugar and a lot of refined carbohydrates. So like, what should they eat and how can they like manage their blood sugar response?
Yeah, so you know, most people aren't just going to eat a single carbohydrate on itself. They'll have some protein, they'll have some fat that'll curb the glucose curve, right? And it'll be less of a spike. We see that even with 100% whole grains, most of them are ran through a steel roller mill. The particle size is very small. And instead of getting like a small glucose spike and then back to normal baseline, you get a really high spike and you actually go hypoglycemic as well. So you go too low. And so that leads to a vicious cycle of literally craving the sugars, and then you overshoot again, and then you undershoot, and that's a huge problem. So even 100% whole grains, most of the time are issues, particularly breads, like whole 100% whole grain bread. So the healthy carbs would be vegetables and fruit, really. I mean, it's as simple as that. Now, some people who are severely insulin resistant may not want to have too much fruit. They might only want to have one or two pieces of fruit per day until they become more insulin sensitive or they start working out more. But in general, replacing whole grains with fruit and vegetables, and replacing refined sugars with fruits and vegetables as well, those are going to be the best switches in regards to, you know, carb sources.
Mm. And protein is important for the satiety and the weight loss, but also like, adding protein to the meal lowers the glucose response to the meal. And we should say that it's normal for the blood sugar again to rise, but if it stays elevated for, you know, hours and hours after eating, then that's a sign of insulin resistance and poor glucose tolerance. So it's not, you don't really have to fear the spikes or the rises in blood sugar after eating. It's just, the longer it stays elevated, the kind of worse it is.
Yeah, like fear the really high spikes that are super physiologic, that are abnormally high. Fear the ones that, and the thing is, you could be producing a ton of insulin and maybe that's why it's not staying elevated though. So you might see a curve that, the curve looks pretty good, but you just shot your insulin sky high to keep it low. So really avoid the super physiological spikes, which are going to be driven by the whole grains and they're going to be driven by the refined sugars in particular in beverage form. But like you said, adding protein, adding fiber and adding fat to a meal will all reduce the glucose spike, will increase satiety, And so that's one way to sort of buffer. And we talk about also apple cider vinegar, like 1 to 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar diluted in about 8 ounces of water, you know, 15 minutes or even during a meal can reduce the glucose spike. And then like a 10 to 15 minute, ideally 15 minute walk after a meal will also help reduce glucose spikes as well. And then the other sort of hack is berries, like polyphenols from berries can help reduce the glucose spike as well.
Vinegar, you know, some olive oil or I mean, nuts do also have been found to lower the blood sugar response, but it's probably because they have like added fats, maybe a little bit of fiber and the polyphenols as well. But yeah, like I think the biggest, you know, leverage or the lever in affecting the postprandial glucose response is going to be like just making sure that the meal is high in protein and fiber and maybe apple cider vinegar. But yeah, like you can just increase your insulin sensitivity by making sure that you have like moved around or exercised around the meal. So like before and after, like a walk. And I mean, yeah, like just, you know, exercising is just like such a crucial part in all of this. Like if you don't exercise, then your body is never going to be actually insulin sensitive in a lot of ways. Like because if you exercise, then just, you know, you could sit on the couch and still be very insulin sensitive and still have like a very normal response to the meal. And it's just that many people are sedentary and they don't have that enough muscle tissue, so they're, you know, because the muscle is the largest kind of bank for storing glucose inside the body. And if your muscles are activated and let's say depleted of the glucose, then they're just gonna be they're just gonna soak up all the glucose without really affecting the blood sugar response after the meal that much.
Right. Yep. And then the other thing is just being deficient in numerous nutrients, single nutrients. So take for example thiamine. Back in 1939 and back in 1940, there were a couple of studies done that literally showed within just a couple of weeks, but certainly within 2 to 3 months, if you are consuming less than 0.15 milligrams of thiamine per day, that leads to prediabetes and type 2 diabetic glucose curves. So we've known for over 80 years that to being deficient in one vitamin, vitamin B1, thiamine, can literally cause prediabetes and type 2 diabetes. Virtually no clinician knows about this, and certainly the general public doesn't know about this. And the reason is because thiamine sits at the top of glucose metabolism. So in order to oxidize glucose, you know, you got to go through glycolysis. There's enzymes that will take glucose to pyruvate and then bring pyruvate into the Krebs cycle, right? Via acetyl-CoA, and then, you know, form ATP. So all these enzymes require thiamine. Transketolase is one. Now, transketolase is important too because it keeps glucose running to the pyruvate Krebs cycle pathway, pushes it away from the advanced glycation end product pathway. So when you're deficient in thiamine, you produce less advanced glycation end products, you produce less oxidative stress, and now you're bringing glucose into the Krebs cycle, right? As pyruvate slash, and then you have acetyl-CoA. But pyruvate dehydrogenase, in order to bring pyruvate into the Krebs cycle, that enzyme requires thiamine. And then alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase, another enzyme that converts alpha-ketoglutarate to succinyl-CoA in the Krebs cycle, requires thiamine. So literally for you, your body to make ATP out of glucose, you need thiamine. And that's why if you're deficient in it, it can cause type 2 diabetes. Now, the form of thiamine that actually activates those enzymes is thiamine diphosphate or pyrophosphate. It's an activated form. You have to activate it in the body. And the other nutrient that's required to do that is magnesium. So if you're deficient in thiamine, you're deficient in magnesium, that can literally induce type 2 diabetes or prediabetes.
Magnesium deficiency is almost linearly associated with increased heart disease as well as diabetes. Where can people get the magnesium as well as thiamine?
So that's a good question. So thiamine, one of the best sources that we used to think was pork. Now, more recent samples that have looked at pork have been going down. And that's probably because as carbon dioxide goes up, the thiamine in plant foods goes down. And then thus animals feed on those lower thiamine plant foods. So both plants and animals now have less thiamine. And many things can cause thiamine deficiency. So I used to never even care about vitamin B1 or thiamine. I never looked into it for a long time because I knew that all our refined carbs, most of them were fortified with B1, just a little bit, not a ton though. And I was like, well, if it's fortified, we're, you know, shouldn't be a problem. But the thing is so many things, we don't store a lot of thiamine. This is the key. We only store about 30 milligrams. So you can become rapidly depleted in all of your thiamine stores within days, just being sick. Like if you have an infection, inflammation, activity, when you are more physically active, your thiamine requirements dramatically skyrocket. And then anything like even diarrhea, drinking coffee or tea close to your intake of foods have basically polyphenols and things that will inactivate thiamine, but also reduce the absorption of thiamine. Raw shellfish, so like sushi and things like that, sulfites will break down thiamine. So certain wines. So there's all these things, and you start adding all these things up. Once I started learning that, I started understanding, okay, thiamine deficiency is a huge issue here. Not to mention that simply having a high carb diet dramatically increases your need for thiamine. So there was some good studies where they gave people parenteral nutrition, you know, high in carbs, it instantly induced thiamine deficiency. So, you know, good sources, it's hard to say what a good source is nowadays of anything, because plant sources and animal sources of nutrients have gone down. But yeah, pork is traditionally like your best source. Whole grains typically have more thiamine than non-whole grains, but then you also increase your thiamine requirement by ingesting whole grains. So it's hard to say if that's giving you a net positive or not. So you can't just look at like, does the food have a lot of thiamine? How well is it being absorbed? And is it causing your needs to go up? So it's really good. Most people should probably be supplementing with some type of thiamine just to cover their bases. Especially since if you've been on a low thiamine diet for a long time, the enzymes require sometimes very, very high doses to reactivate. And that's partly why I think a lot of the people consuming just the bare minimum with fortified whole grains, it's not enough to reactivate those enzymes that have been shut off due to a very low intake of thiamine for a long period of time.
Gotcha. And how much would, if some people would supplement, how much would like the optimal dose be?
So a lot of studies have looked at benfotiamine, which is sort of like a thiamine alternative, using anywhere from 350 milligrams twice a day to three times a day, showing benefits on glucose control in type 2 diabetics, showing benefits on A1C, adding probably thiamine HCL 50 milligrams a day to that would probably not be a bad idea. And then the best thiamine supplement is called allythiamine. It's called thiamine tetrahydrofurfural disulfide. Was invented in Japan. It's basically a synthetic form of the thiamine in garlic, which is a very, very highly cell bioavailable and brain bioavailable thiamine, which benfotiamine and thiamine HCL can't really get into the brain. Benfotiamine has great access to certain cells like red blood cells, but doesn't have good access to the brain. You have to take really high doses. That's why allythiamine, I take all three, thiamine HCL, benfotiamine, and allythiamine. Now, I've tested just taking allythiamine on my own blood sugar level. So my A1C was 5.2 to 5.3. 3 months of 300 milligrams of allythiamine took my A1C from 5.2 to 5.3 down to 4.8. Just doing that was the only thing I changed. That's a pretty good move, especially in an insulin-sensitive range. So, you know, someone who's in a diabetic range could potentially see even better improvements.
Wow. that's awesome. Yeah, I definitely need to consider, or maybe I think about maybe adding thiamine to my supplement list right now, but I'm not taking thiamine myself. One mineral that I do supplement for the purpose of managing blood sugar and insulin sensitivity is chromium, which is actually also very, very powerful in lowering blood sugar levels and affecting insulin sensitivity.
Yeah, chromium is hugely underrated. Just like thiamine, a lot of things can cause chromium deficiency. We lose it in sweat. When we consume carbohydrates, it releases chromium in the cell to handle that carb. And then we lose that chromium in the urine. And then exercise increases your requirements of chromium as well. So what's really bad is that the bioavailability of chromium is only 1%. So when you lose it, you have to get 100-fold intake to replace that 1% back. So we lose, I don't know, you know, there's certain sweat studies that would suggest that if you sweat for 1 hour, you may need 100 to 300 to 400 micrograms of chromium to replace what's lost, because again, only 1% is bioavailable. So if you lose, you know, 1 microgram of chromium, you need to ingest 100 micrograms to get that 1 microgram back. So that's really why chromium is so vital. And then there's been numerous studies, anywhere from 200 micrograms to 1,000 micrograms per day, the higher end in those who are type 2 diabetic, showing improvements in A1C, glucose control, and even fat loss and muscle gain too, which is kind of interesting, probably because it allows insulin to work better. Insulin drives, you know, amino acids and you know, synthesis of muscle and things like that too.
Yeah, yeah, like that's a big, you know, misunderstanding about insulin. They think it's all bad, but insulin has so many like very important roles. Yeah, like, you know, muscle growth, it's a very, very anabolic hormone. It helps to store nutrients. So if you're like insulin resistant or you don't produce insulin, then yeah, like even the micronutrients aren't able to enter the cells either. So yeah, it's quite crucial. And when it comes to actually, you know, the hypertension and the things like that, then insulin is the one that like releases this vascular endothelial factor and improves endothelial function, whereas in insulin resistance it doesn't happen. So it's, again, you know, insulin has like either a good role or a bad role depending on if you're insulin sensitive or if you're insulin resistant.
Yep. And if you're insulin resistant too, especially at the cellular level, let's go back to magnesium. Magnesium is driven into the cell as well as potassium from insulin. So if you're insulin resistant, you are also typically magnesium deficient at the cellular level because you have a lower amount of magnesium and potassium going into the cell. Elevated insulin levels also increase the urinary excretion of magnesium. And so you'll see type 2 diabetics, they'll have an elevated urinary magnesium, but their ionic magnesium, which is the activated form, is down in the blood. So typically 50% of type 2 diabetics are magnesium deficient. So they're not activating their thiamine as well, right? And so they're not able to burn their glucose appropriately, which also elevates lactic acid and leads to tissue and basically, you know, this acute in certain tissues, ischemia as well. So you can literally have poor glucose metabolism causing oxidative stress, tissue ischemia, buildup of lactic acid. So it's just a mess when your body doesn't have the nutrients to allow the metabolic engine to run.
Yeah. And what you know causes the insulin resistance in the first place? Like, you know, why does it develop, and at like what point like does it develop?
So it kind of like what we talked about before, you have certain nutrients like chromium, like thiamine, like magnesium that have to activate enzymes to metabolize glucose. And so that's part of it. Then you also, we cover lack of inositol, right? But actually our body makes inositol through magnesium. So magnesium deficiency can also decrease the production of inositol, which when insulin hits its receptor, inositol compounds are released, which cause GLUT4 to rise to the cell and allow glucose into the cell. So there's another pathway, not having enough inositol or being magnesium deficient. And then a lack of salt, sodium, another essential nutrient. I recently published a review of 23 human clinical studies showing that low salt diets induce insulin resistance or worsen fasting insulin or postprandial glucose or postprandial insulin. And there's many mechanisms for that. If you don't get enough of this essential nutrient like salt, you have an activation of noradrenaline and catecholamines, which can induce insulin resistance themselves. You have a decrease in blood flow to the skeletal muscle. So you have a decrease in glucose and insulin delivery to the skeletal muscle, hence elevations in glucose and insulin with low salt diets. And then you have an activation in aldosterone, other stress hormones. So, you know, there's many ways to induce insulin resistance at the cellular level. There can be many pathways that are getting broken down. Inflammation from overconsuming sugar and carbs as well can cause it. So that's just kind of, you know, what yeah. happens.
Yeah, there's no like a yeah, single cause. It's not like, yeah, one person is eating, let's say, too much sugar and then they're instantly insulin resistant. It's that, yeah, like the combination of all those things. And what happens over time is that you know, yeah, like the pathology of insulin resistance develops when, you know, the pancreas either doesn't produce enough insulin, which usually occurs if the pancreatic beta cells become damaged, or there's, or the cells themselves become, yeah, resistant to the insulin, that they're not, you know, allowing the insulin to open the cells. So yeah, like it's all these other factors cause that, you know, oxidative stress inflammation damages the beta cells. And yeah, like even if they're, if you're like either like there's too much sugar or carbohydrates consumed too frequently, then the cells become resistant. Or if you have like hyperinsulinemia, like too high insulin levels frequently elevated as well, it makes the cells like tone deaf, for lack of a better word, to the insulin. And yeah, then you just have hyper high circulating of insulin and high circulating of blood sugar at the same time.
Yeah. And you, I mean, you can go down the rabbit hole even more, where if you consume certain foods like refined seed oils, refined carbs and sugars, if you damage the intestinal lining, and you have an increase in intestinal permeability, that can lead to what's called endotoxemia, right? An increase in lipopolysaccharide in the blood, which can then cause central insulin leptin resistance as well as peripheral, because essentially LPS can activate toll-like receptors. So you have activation of immune cells, which release tumor necrosis factor alpha, literally damaging the parts in the hypothalamus that control satiety and hunger, right? So there is a million pathways that go on in the body that can cause insulin leptin resistance. But it all comes down to a lot of the same things. You're eating the bad foods. You're not eating enough of the good nutrients and the good foods. You're not active enough. You don't have enough muscle. You're not getting enough maybe sunlight and vitamin D. So, you know, there's a million ways to skin a cat.
Yeah, and it actually like varies during the 24-hour period as well. So like at some points of the day, you are more insulin sensitive, and at other times you're less and more insulin resistant. Because when you're sleeping, you know, ideally you should sleep in darkness where you have high circulating melatonin. And melatonin's job is, or I mean, some of the effects of melatonin is that it actually makes you somewhat insulin resistant by blocking the release of insulin by the pancreatic beta cells. And I mean, melatonin is important for the anti-inflammatory and antioxidant benefits, but it does make you like insulin resistant as well, which is, you know, kind of healthy to be that, you know, like a optimally optimal sleep to be like somewhat insulin resistant. And in the daytime, you are generally more insulin sensitive because you're not producing melatonin if you're like exposed to sunlight and other lights. And yeah, like glucose tolerance varies during the daytime as well. So, and that's one thing that we cover in the book as well, like the circadian rhythm aspect, which is very overlooked, but yeah, like actually one of the major determinants of your like daily insulin sensitivity.
Yeah, so the simple thing is to make sure you're getting good morning sunlight. You're not getting a lot of artificial light at night. Those are the two keys, because sleep deprivation very quickly leads to insulin resistance as well. So that is a very overlooked issue, is poor sleep. And light controls that. Not getting enough light in the morning, getting too much light, artificial light at night, can all mess up your circadian rhythms and hence lead to insulin resistance, prediabetes.
Yeah, that's absolutely. We can definitely talk about like the fats as well, because like, you know, first of all, excess fat consumption generally doesn't, you know, directly cause like diabetes, but it can certainly induce some aspects of insulin resistance. And especially like if you're in a calorie surplus, or if you're eating those excess fats together with the carbohydrates. You mentioned the Randall cycle initially in the beginning. So yeah, we can, because yeah, like excess or high triglyceride levels are also one of the, you know, hallmarks of insulin resistance and diabetes. So yeah, we can cover like the, what's the role of fats in this as well.
Yeah. So there's a huge debate on, are seed oils harmful or not? It comes down to the type of seed oil, like how it's extracted. Is it cold pressed or is it high heat hexane extracted? That's two totally different oils. One is oxidized, one is not. And then how much are you consuming? Obviously, if you consume a very little bit of oxidized seed oil, it's probably not a big deal. If you consume a fair amount for a long period of time, probably a big deal. And then are you cooking those seed oils? When you cook omega-6 seed oils, particularly highly refined ones, that is going to dramatically increase the harmful effects. So those fats will absolutely harm the body and will contribute to insulin resistance. We know that trans fats too are harmful to the body. Technically, no level of intake of trans fats is healthy. And then in regards to fat, like you said, fat on its own isn't really that harmful. It's when you start combining them with carbohydrates, where particularly long chain saturated fats seem to induce a little bit more metabolic harm than, let's say, monounsaturated, which is why like the Mediterranean diet seems to be able to get away with more carbs because you're having more monounsaturated fats, just because long chain saturated fats have a lower oxidation rate. And so they don't get burned as easily. And that's a problem. That's not a problem when you're not eating a lot of carb, but that becomes a problem when you start eating 300 grams of carbohydrates. You start eating a lot of butter, heavy cream, right? Cheeses, dairies. When you start doing that, the combination of that too can be pretty bad regarding fat gain, regarding insulin resistance.
Yeah. So like the pathology of that situation is that you know, first when you eat like fats, then if you are eating them together with carbohydrates, then you will see a rise in triglycerides in the blood, which is, you know, normal to have a rise in triglycerides in the blood. But because you're also eating carbohydrates, your blood sugar rises and the body still prioritizes, you know, burning glucose for fuel. And that's why the triglycerides from the fats stay elevated in the blood for longer, because you're not in ketosis because of eating carbs, and you're not really burning those fats for fuel either, because your body is burning the carbohydrates. If you're in a calorie deficit, then you probably will burn all of that. But if you're, you know, eating like a calorie maintenance or in a surplus, then yeah, like just the triglycerides stay in the blood for elevated longer time. So you experience this hypertriglyceridemia, which then eventually causes this lipotoxicity that starts to damage the beta cells. And yeah, like the different fats have like a different effect on the beta cell damage. And yeah, like the saturated fats will generally have like a slightly more damage to the beta cells, whereas like omega-3 fats actually have like one of the least damage. And if you like over time just, you know, experience this lipotoxicity, which yeah is caused actually by the combination of the sugars and fats through disrupting the Randall cycle, the fatty acid glucose oxidation cycle, so that's what is kind of resulting in this lipotoxicity, and over time it damages the beta cells, and that's when you develop insulin resistance. So the main message is to don't eat like large amounts of fats and carbs together, either eat them separately or just, you know, if you're in a calorie deficit, then you can still get away with it a little bit, but it's still not like the optimal ideal way to go.
Yeah, and you know, endogenous saturated fats seem to be driven by your carb intake, and Volek and colleagues did some good studies on that, that basically, even though a low carb diet had three times the saturated fat, that when you consumed a diet higher in carbs, the actual saturated fats in the blood were much higher in the higher carb diet. So it's like you can sort of dial up or down the saturated fats in your body by dialing up or down the carbs. The carb content really drives a lot of that saturated fat in the body, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah. And like the Randall cycle just, yeah, refers to your body's like innate function of, it chooses, like you always burn a mixture of different fuels. You always burn a mixture of carbs, fats, lactate as well, but, or ketones. And it's just the, yeah, like the main focus is going to be on one or the other. If you're in ketosis, then you burn mostly fats and ketones. And if you're not in ketosis, which, you know, 90% of other people are, then you're going to burn, you know, glucose first and then a little bit of mixture of fats as well. But yeah, like if you just have too much fats in the blood from eating fats, then it can stay elevated for a bit longer.
Yeah. And then the other very confusing thing as well is you have a lot of plant-based doctors saying that low carb diets induce insulin resistance, and really it's non-pathological carb intolerance. Like when you don't eat carb, when you give someone an oral glucose tolerance test, they're going to look insulin resistant, which is why you're supposed to be on a moderate carb intake for at least 2 weeks before you get like an oral glucose tolerance or an insulin assay to determine if you are actually insulin resistant, because we know that consuming a very low amount of carbs for a long period of time will make you carb intolerant. So it's kind of like a short-term non-pathological thing going on. But as you and I both agree, we don't believe that someone should be in chronic ketosis. It's too stressful of a state. chronically, it's probably not good for thyroid health. You need pulses of insulin, you need pulses of carbs, for numerous reasons, metabolic health, mental health, thyroid health, things like that. So going in and out of ketosis because you are exercising or building muscle or not consuming a ton of carbs is fine, but chronic ketosis is probably not a great idea.
Yeah, and it is, you know, shown that ketogenic diets, low carb diets, they do work in improving insulin resistance and blood sugar levels quite rapidly, and it's slightly better than high carb diets. But at the end of the day, like both diets, whether it's a low carb, high fat diet, or a higher carb, lower fat diet, they can still result in better, you know, glycemic control and better insulin sensitivity over time. It's just in the short term, it appears that, yeah, like a carb restriction in the short term is definitely superior to like a higher carb intake. But yeah, if you're healthy, then there's no reason to, you know, you don't have a metabolic requirement to be on a like a carb restricted diet.
Yeah. The other factor that can induce insulin resistance as well is actually not balancing your acid-base balance. I've published a couple of review papers on acid-base and how the diet affects that. And essentially, your interstitial fluid will become acidic much faster than your blood, even though blood pH literally does become more acidic as we age, as we consume a more acidic diet that's not being balanced by base. You will see the pH of the blood go from like 7.42 or 7.45 down to like 7.36, and the blood is more acidic, but it's still considered normal. But the interstitial fluid doesn't have the buffering capacity like the blood does. And so the interstitial fluid will become more acidic, and thus the receptors, the insulin receptors, you can literally cause insulin resistance by having too much acid in the interstitial fluid. So balancing acid base is important. You don't have to consume plant foods to do that. Although fruits and vegetables will offset the acid of animal foods, but you can also consume bicarbonate mineral waters, or you can consume like sodium citrate or sodium bicarbonate. I prefer citrate because it doesn't mess with the pH of the stomach. Supplements to offset some of the acid load of, let's say, an animal-based diet. And that will help also with insulin sensitivity as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Is there anything else that we, obviously there's, yeah, like we said, many other, you know, pathways and mechanisms that contribute to this, but the main overview is, yeah, like insulin resistance is one of the, or is the kind of the main, let's say, cause or driver of diabetes and other glucose intolerance, let's say, syndromes. And insulin resistance is caused by, yeah, like multiple things. It can be caused by excess carbohydrate intake, excess sugar intake. It can be caused by sleep deprivation, being sedentary, some nutrient deficiencies, circadian mismatch, etc. And it's possible to reverse that. We didn't cover type 1 diabetes here, but we do talk about it in the book as well, which is unfortunately, you know, not like a lifestyle caused issue. It's mostly like genetic. But diabetes is, or like, you know, you can still improve your insulin sensitivity. You can improve your glucose tolerance, and it doesn't matter if you already have pre-diabetes or if you don't. If you're already healthy, then it's still, prevention is the best medicine, and it's kind of important to know, you know, how to actually improve your blood sugar levels.
Yep.
And people can get the book from Amazon. It should be out now. And is there anything else you want to say?
No, I think what's really interesting is people are going to find out there's a lot of different ways, a lot of different pairings of foods that can help fix their blood sugar besides just what you're typically told, like cut out carbs, right? And so this is a refreshing book because it gives a complete overview on numerous factors that can induce insulin resistance, pre-diabetes, type 2 diabetes.
Yeah, awesome. And it was great talking with you, and I'll see you around.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you want to support this podcast, then check out our sponsors and leave a review on iTunes or Spotify. My name is Seem. Stay tuned for the next episode. Stay empowered.